New Dimensions is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in conversation with Michael Toms. New Dimensions and our quarter-hour New Dimensions Cafe programs are now available worldwide as podcasts. You can find them at the iTunes Store and on many podcast sites and mobile apps. You can also find our podcasts and much more on our website, newdimensions.org. It is only through a change in human consciousness that the world will be transformed. The personal and the planetary are connected. As we expand our awareness of mind, body, psyche, and spirit, and bring that awareness actively into the world, so also will the world be changed. This is our quest as we explore new dimensions.
Listener, thanks for joining us. I'd like to begin today's conversation by giving you a flavor of the writings and observations of my guest, Margaret Rinkle. She writes, "The natural world's perfect indifference has always been the best cure for my own anxieties. Every living thing, every bird and mammal and reptile and amphibian, every tree and shrub and flower and moss is pursuing its own vital purpose, a purpose that sets my human concerns in a larger context. The dramas and worries and pain that are the warp of my life, woven tightly through the light and love and joy that are its weft, don't register on the blue jay at all. The earthworms beneath the soil have the least idea of the frets that pluck at my heart. In their rest, I find rest. And the natural world is everywhere, not just in my wild yard or on my favorite trail at a local park or in the woods beside a borrowed cabin. It's in the branches of the sidewalk trees as they begin to split open and change the grayscape to green. It's in the sparrows and the starlings taking nesting materials into the cracks around the windows and doorways of commercial buildings. It's in a sky full of drifting clouds and in the sandhill cranes flying beneath the clouds." So, dear listener, join me as I sit down with Margaret Rinkle, who will assuredly inspire us with her observations and reports on the natural beauty, human decency, and persistent hope. Margaret Rinkle is a contributing opinion writer for the New York Times, where her essays appear weekly, and has been recognized with numerous prestigious awards for her writing. She's the founding editor of Chapter 16, a daily literary publication of Humanities Tennessee, and is a graduate of Auburn University and the University of South Carolina, and is now living in Nashville. Her books include Late Migrations, A Natural History of Love and Loss, and Graceland at Last, Notes on Hope and Heartache from the American South. And today we'll be exploring the book, The Comfort of Crows, A Backyard Year. So join us for the next hour as we explore creatures and plants that exist in our own backyards with our guest, Margaret Rinkle. I'm speaking with Margaret from her home by remote connection. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. I'll be your host. Welcome to New Dimensions. Margaret, welcome.
Thank you, Justine. Thank you for having me. I wish you would come and read my book to me all the way through. It sounds so much better in your voice than in mine.
I want to tell you, I just delighted in this book. You stimulated so much writing for me. I started to recall all sorts of wild animals and things that I have experienced in my life that I had forgotten. Thank you for this enormous gift. What I'd like to start with is kind of what you start the book with, actually, is a birding tradition. The first bird you see in the new year will set the tone for the rest of the year. So I'd love for you to tell me about that birding tradition. And maybe even if you'd share, did you do it this year and what bird came to you this year?
I do it every year. It's a tradition I read about for the first time in a book by Leanda Lynn Haupt. And I'm not a true birder in the sense that I don't really have a life list or any list. I don't go to places explicitly hoping to see or look for birds. I'm just a person who likes to know as much as I can about my neighbors, about my wild neighbors. And so this was an unfamiliar tradition to me, not being a true birder. But ever since I read about it, I have been doing it every year. This year, my first bird, and it's called all kinds of different things. That's why I'm hesitating over how to express it. But my first bird was a blue jay. And I was happy about that because a blue jay is a corvid. It belongs to the group of corvids, the group to which crows also belong. And in the book, the book is not a book about crows or even about birds specifically, but I write about the extravagant intelligence of that group of birds. Corvids have a brain to body ratio that is huge. The brain is really extravagantly large in these birds. Only primates have a bigger brain to body ratio. And so they're so clever and funny. And I remember this didn't happen in January. It's not in January, birds are very focused on survival. But last summer, we had a red-tailed hawk fledgling who would be in the nearby trees crying continually for someone to come and feed it. I think its parents were trying to teach it to be a little bit more resourceful. And there was a blue jay in my yard who started imitating the baby hawk. And I couldn't see any reason for doing it. It wasn't doing it. Sometimes blue jays have reportedly used hawk imitations to clear a bird feeder so they can get to the food themselves, sending the other birds scattering. But I loved this bird just seemed to be having fun playing around with music and song.
I love it. And, you know, when I read something in your book that reminded me of a short story that Mark Twain wrote called What Stumped the Blue Jays? And you can get it online. Just look it up. It's just delightful. And one of the things that he says is that whatever a blue jay feels, it can put into language. And then it also, he says, a blue jay can outswear any gentleman miners, any gentleman in the mines, or yeah. I had remembered any sailor, but it was, that's not what he wrote. But anyway, and that reminds me also of crows that have all that language. If you listen to them, is that right? Have you hear the different inflections? And what's your experience of crows?
Well, crows are the interesting thing about crows. One of the interesting things about crows is in their language is that they, we of course associate them with the caw-caw. Everybody recognizes the sound of a crow, but they have many, many dozens of vocalizations that are apparently very clear to one another what they mean. And unlike most other birds, crows continue to talk to one another through the winter months. Most songbirds, especially little bitty birds, they're using all of their calories to keep warm. You know, winter is a time when there are fewer resources. There's less to eat because, there are no seeds. There are very few berries left. All the insects have died or underground or in the leaf litter. And meanwhile, just when the food sources are disappearing, it's getting colder and colder, and the birds are having to shiver to keep warm, and that burns a lot of calories. And so they don't, generally speaking, spend a lot of time singing or calling to one another, but crows keep right on talking. They're always talking to one another. And in fact, crows are more vocal, at least around here, in the winter, when they've flocked up again. In the mating season, they separate into different territories to mate and raise their young. But they come back together when the weather begins to get cold again in the fall, and they spend all winter just talking, talking, talking.
I never, I want to say that I had an experience of crows. I was on a vision quest at one point where I was 3 days out by myself on the desert to the east of the Sierra near Mount Whitney. And the first day I saw three crows riding the thermals as if they were hawks. I mean, they weren't flapping at all. They were just gliding. And it was so unusual. I looked at them and I thought, oh my goodness. Then on the third day, Margaret, I heard all this squawking. I mean, just the biggest ruckus. And I looked up and there were the three crows flying back up the thermal in the opposite direction. And I just felt like they were swearing to one another and saying, whose idea was this? It was just funny. It made me burst out into laughter. And what you do and what you have accomplished in this book is you're helping us get focused on something other than our computer screens or our TV screens or whatever, and really starting to notice what is right outside our door. I mean, all that you've talked about right now is just that you've noticed how the crows will keep talking all through the winter and the other birds don't. How did you start to get interested in this in the first place?
I can't remember ever not being interested in it. I remember as a little girl, I think this is partly my age. I'll be 62 this fall. So I grew up at a place in Lower Alabama at a time in the early 60s when parents weren't quite so vigilant. I spent my whole childhood outdoors.
That's a big subject that I want to get into because I'm really excited to hear you say that. And we'll talk about that, I think you call it feral children. I love it. I love it. So I want to remind our listeners, I'm here with Margaret Ringel, and she is the author of many books, including The Comfort of Crows, A Backyard Year. And if you want to know more about her, you can go to her website, margaretringel.com, and she spells her name, last name, R-E-N-K-L, or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions. here with Margaret Rinkle, and we're talking about the natural world right outside our window. And Margaret, you've just said that you grew up in rural Alabama, Andalusia, Alabama, and you grew up with a lot of freedom as a child. So talk about that freedom.
Well, Andalusia is not a rural community, I should be clear. Okay. It's a small town. But and we left it when I was seven to move to Birmingham. But because of some periods of time when my mother wasn't really able to mother, and this is all something I write about in Late Migration, so it's not a secret. But my brother and sister and I spent a great part of our childhood in rural Alabama, with our grandparents on the farm, often for, you know, several weeks at a time in the summer or before we were in school, and then many, many weekends throughout the year. And I think it was partly a combination of there just not really being any built-in entertainment for children. I mean, I think Sesame Street even wasn't invented until I was well in school. So it was partly just that there wasn't any like TV to watch and hardly really any children's books, but it was also partly that I think children are just inherently interested in the natural world. So nobody really thought about it. I mean, our mother would say, go out and play, by which she meant go anywhere you want to as long as you stay together and come back when you're hungry, essentially.
For me, when I lived in rural Mendocino County, we had an all-year creek. And I would run up that creek and back and forth. And one time we had a visitor from a city, and he had grown up in the Bronx in New York. And when we were jumping from boulder to boulder, he stopped me. He said, wait, I can't go as fast as you can. And we talked about that. And because he grew up in a way that the land was flat. It was like cement, and it was right angles, and it was, you know, nothing obstructed his movement around. And I grew up, like you did, with jumping on boulders and moving from place to place. And it made me think, Margaret, that there's something in our growing up that we learn somatically in our body, that we learn how to do that. That we, you know, hear what I'm saying? That
I think that landscapes, you know, that we get impressed upon, imprinted almost upon the landscapes that we were raised in, and forever afterward, we feel a little bit ill at ease, maybe in radically different landscapes. There's a certain slant of light, there's a certain density of trees, there's a certain hilliness or lack thereof that makes us feel at home. And when we don't have it, we might not be consciously really even registering that lack or that missing thing. But when we get it back, we feel it pretty much immediately, I think.
I agree. I'm just thinking also, as we're talking, we've done a lot of programs with leaders in the environmental movement and done special programming, special series on deep ecology and that. And we would always ask our guests, you know, how do they first get into something? And each one, every one of them, every single one of them talked about their childhood and just being fascinated with something in the natural world. So whether it was like going to your stories of you and your brother finding tadpoles and doing an aquarium with tadpoles, And so tell us about that. I mean, how old were you and what how did you start that and what happened and what did you learn?
I think probably I was around 8 and Billy was around 7. Because our little sister was born. So, just not old enough to be with us. We lived near a 12-month creek and we observed the tadpoles and the stages of tadpoles, and we just thought it would be fun to watch them up close. And we had an aquarium that was not able to be used as an aquarium anymore because it had a crack in the glass, and we turned it into a terrarium that had no top, which is a fact of the terrarium that figures prominently in the story of why we had to take the toads that our tadpoles had turned into back into the woods. But it was just one of the things. We did that kind of thing all the time. It was just wanting to be up close and see it and share it. And nobody, you know, my mother used to walk around going, you know, I don't live in a home. I live in a project center, because we were always making something, creating something. You know, they were very tolerant, my dad and my mom, I had every kind of animal you could imagine living in my bedroom at one time or another when I was that age.
That's wonderful. Well, let's talk about toads and frogs for a moment, because they really are an indicator species as far as what is the health of our environment. And so what is the health of our environment when you look at that species?
Well, I'm not trying to position myself as one of the kinds of environmental writers you mentioned earlier who are true experts in their field. I want to be clear that I'm just a person who sits on the back steps or looks out the window or walks in the park. I don't have any special expertise. I'm not an ornithologist or an entomologist or a herpetologist. So, you know, all I can tell you is what I've observed myself in my own little half acre. We've lived in this house 28 years, and I have not seen a toad in this yard in at least 2 decades. I can't remember the last time I saw a toad. And there's a whole essay in the Comfort of Crows about how that essay that you were talking about just how extravagant the amphibian and reptile life was in those days. And, yes. and we're talking only 50 years ago.
Yes.
It's amazing, but it makes sense when you think about it. Amphibians have very thin, porous skin. And so if there are toxins in the environment, those toxins are felt by amphibian life much more immediately. I'm not going to say less than we feel it, but the ramifications are more immediate than they are to us. But I think those toxins that are in our environment are clearly linked to a number. They have been linked to a number of human illnesses too, and they are collectively known as endocrine disruptors because of that connection, not necessarily demonstrated beyond all shadow of a doubt connection, but definitely a connection between high levels of toxins like lawn pesticides, like herbicides and like insecticides that have been linked to everything from breast cancer to autism to ADD to just an incredible
Alzheimer's and maybe Parkinson's.
Yep, Parkinson's for sure. Yeah. Yeah. And Parkinson's has been linked to chemical fertilizer. It's not even an insecticide. So it's but we haven't as a culture or even in large numbers made that connection.
Yeah.
I know so many people with young children who will go to Whole Foods to buy organic milk for their kids, but then let their lawn services drench their yards with poison.
Right.
Never even seeing the disconnect
And then you see the kids rolling around and on the lawn. I mean, we've all done it when we were growing up and rolling around on the lawn, and they're just picking up all the that pesticide right in the skin.
That's right.
Yeah.
But you know, they don't, that connection isn't as clear, but when you've lived in the same house for 28 years and there are no toads in your yard.
Yeah.
The connection's much more transparent, I think. And you know what else and the toad was filled with? Was insects. Your windshield and hitting your headlights.
Oh.
We don't see that anymore either.
I was wondering why that was. Thank you. But, you know, within a couple of years, it was only a couple of years they all disappeared. Within a couple of years, no more. I was shocked. So
we know that there's, you know, like the plummeting population of monarch butterflies is, I mean, just transparently connected to genetically modified corn. Because the corn, when we talk about genetically modified crops, what they're modified to do is withstand the effects of a particular herbicide that we know as Roundup. And and so instead of even using chemicals on a specific field and then going to the next field and using chemicals, farmers were able to just indiscriminately, you know, spray this glyphosate or Roundup just from, you know, horizon to horizon, and they were wiping out milkweed, the plant that monarch butterflies, right through the heart of America in the primary monarch flyway.
Yeah.
And you saw in the very next year this unbelievable dramatic drop in monarch butterfly numbers and like 80% gone in 1 year's time. So all it takes is one change of that magnitude and it can affect whole populations.
Exactly. And that's such a, that particular butterfly is so unique in so far as its migration patterns going from Central Mexico up to Canada. And also it's the only species that I think has what they call a variable interval of life cycle, which is just amazing because they several generations, it takes several generations to get up to Canada. One generation to get back, and that generation then roosts together in these clusters in the Oilamel forests of central Mexico that are also being destroyed. But anyway, they congregate there and they live 9 months. That one generation, and then they started.
You know what
all
they
over.
Call that one generation?
Tell me.
I love this. They call it the Methuselah generation.
Oh.
Isn't that great?
Isn't that fine? Oh, that's so fine. I'm running out of time here. I'm here with Margaret Rinkle, and we're talking about all sorts of wonderful natural things that occur in the planet. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions.